The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 24, 2025, ordered in red on the front cover and a narrow white inner border. Time is in large capital block lettering in white and off-white, imposed upon a whitish-gray background. For young people, the cover, these are photographs of two blonde women, two dark-haired men. Giancarlo, diagnosed with lung cancer at 18. Kelly, diagnosed with colorectal cancer at 28. Imtiaz, diagnosed with colon cancer at 26. Carrie, diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 40. The story, Why It's Now Striking Us So Young, by Amy Ducharme, will follow within a few minutes. Beginning today with an essay, The Real Problem with Fake Plants, by Maria Belasca. Belasca is a philosopher and psychologist whose research on fake nature is funded by the Kone, K-O-N-E, Foundation. Her latest book is Anxiety and Wonder on Being Human. When the German philosopher Immanuel Kant puzzled over why nature looks beautiful to us, he considered the case of replicas. Imagine, Kahn wrote in the late 1700s, a jovial innkeeper who, for lack of a nightingale to enchant his guests, plays a trick on them by hiding a boy in a bush with a reed, hitting off nature to perfection. Kant, that's K-A-N-T, was sure the moment people found out the truth, no one will long endure listening to this sound. Why should that be if the sound is identical? Kant's confidence may seem out of place today. Copies of nature proliferate. Not only can we go skiing in Dubai and sunbathe on tropical indoor beaches in Germany, but fake plants and synthetic lawns are filling up our cities, restaurants, and homes. The global artificial flowers market is predicted to reach $1.78 billion this year. Bewilderingly, faux flowers, the upmarket term for fake, are even presented as a green alternative. Faced with impressively elaborate copies of plants that never droop or wither, and living increasingly convenience-based lives, a lot of us may wonder if we're justified to choose natural over fake, and on what grounds. Yet research consistently shows experiencing real nature, from having houseplants to gardening, has unparalleled mental health benefits that are significantly diminished in the case of artificial experiences of nature. What is so rewarding about experiencing real nature that cannot be replicated by artificial copies? Philosophers long ago identified one unexpected pleasure of natural beings. Aristotle thought, asking why can lead to one of the greatest human delights, knowing the world around us. With real nature, we can receive answers that render understandable the most alien-looking and silent beings, from plants to sea urchins and sponges. Much as was the case for Aristotle, who was famously captivated by them. answers to questions like, why does my plant have blossoms and why does it get brown spots? Teach us something about the identity of these living things and what is good and bad for them. This pleasure disappears with fake plants. The only answers I can hope to receive when I ask why is something about the intention of their designer, like that they wanted to give it the appearance of blossoming or make it look a bit unhealthy to more realistically pass for a real plant. In this case, asking why leads us back to ourselves. Everything else that takes place with a fake plant is merely a result of chemical and physical reactions. For instance, imagine I own both a real and a fake plant and place them on a sunny spot in my study. As sunlight hits them, both will feel warm to touch. At higher temperatures, particles speed up and gain energy. But with my real plant, the sunlight also links to photosynthesis, which is vital for its development. Whether the fake plant is warmed by the sun or stays cool when it's cold and dark has no bearing on any process within it. It is neither good nor bad for it. Because a real plant has a life of its own, we can care for it in a way that is not possible for a replica. I can help an acorn become an oak by planting it, but I can neither help a plastic acorn grow into an oak nor impede it from doing so. Receiving answers to our whys allows us to care. We can acquire information to promote the real plant's health, water it, make sure it has enough light. This brings the joy of helping something thrive for its own sake. It can also help us care about other natural beings that suffer because of these impeccable copies. If a deathless copy is produced, waste must follow. That waste results in the death of real living nature. Most of the world's fake plants are indeed made in China's Pearl River Delta, a pollution hot spot. Thinking of plants as lives that serve their own purposes opens up a distinct way of understanding our connection to them. They are independent from us, yet knowable, otherworldly, yet familiar. It is this profound sense of sharedness that we glimpse when we observe our plants' activities. This connection brings us joy and inspires us to care for them. After all, who truly cares about a fake plant? Turning the page now to the View essay. This is The Economy. Insecurity is the New Inequality by Alyssa Quart, who is the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and the author of Bootstrapped: Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Donald Trump's second presidential term has already been accompanied by a cascade of unnerving political and natural events, from the U.S.'s leaving the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Accords to the nighttime firings of inspectors general and pardons of the January 6 rioters, to the raids targeting immigrants in a number of cities, and the wildfires roaring through swaths of Los Angeles. Each new occurrence, in turn, fills many with a greater and greater sense of insecurity. This is our new normal. Uncertainty all the time, at every moment, in all places. I call it terra infirma, an inversion of terra firma or solid ground. The ground beneath our feet is perpetually shifting, and it's hard to keep our balance. This constant uncertainty has an effect as well on how I think about my work as the director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. I have started to consider insecurity as the new inequality. The problem is not just the massive gap between haves and have-nots, though that does keep widening, for those who lack the resources to absorb each new blow. The constant instability hits hardest of all, but in truth, this insecurity affects almost everyone except the wealthiest. author and activist Astra Taylor's book, The Age of Insecurity, has shaped and inspired my understanding of how insecurity manifests in the economy and society right now. Taylor argues that a wide variety of crises, from rising inequality to eroding mental health, have insecurity at their root. In the past decade or so, social researchers have identified proliferating categories of uncertainty. These include not only the political insecurity we're experiencing right now, but also more bespoke varieties like transportation insecurity, the difficulty of reaching destinations because of damaged buses and trains, and informational insecurity owing to content that's been muddled and sullied by deepfakes, disinformation, and paranoia. There are also the politicians who obsess over tariffs or illegal immigrants, supposedly taking jobs, ensuring voters feel a certain degree of insecurity. These politicians then offer themselves up as the voice of common sense, the irony being, of course, that their falsely secure rhetoric just augments our perception of chaos. Insecurity, in fact, has become an indicator by which a number of scholars now assess societal well-being. Groups like the National True Cost of Living Coalition instead consider people's economic security, they explain, by looking beyond the most basic of needs to understand what it truly costs to live. There's also the Economic Policy Uncertainty Index. One of its creators, economist Nicholas Bloom, has referred to key political events as uncertainty shocks that create economic disorder, including Brexit in 2016 and the first Trump presidential election. Insecurity is not just a societal diagnosis of liberals and progressives. GOP pollster Patrick Ruffini argued that a security gap explains the 2024 election results, in which the least secure groups tended to swing toward Republicans. For too long, stability has been framed as a psychological characteristic, a mental steadiness cultivated from within. By the same token, instability has been viewed as a psychological failing that comes from low self-esteem, a history of abuse, or a failure to work on oneself. But in the time of terra infirma, a certain degree of anxiety about insecurity is not a moral failing. It is an honest and insightful reaction to what's happening around us. What we think of as psychological insecurity, or being a classic neurotic, is a state of mind that reflects actual conditions. Insecurity is the key lens through which Terry Friedline, a scholar and the author of Banking on a Revolution, looks at the financial struggles of people on the economic edge. To me, it explains why Trump was elected by people who were not at the bottom of the economy but felt like they were just holding on to social solidity by their fingernails. Much like those described by Barbara Ehrenreich, the political activist and co-founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, in Fear of Falling, I wrote the introduction for the new edition, their feelings of insecurity grow more acute in the late stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, when the government withdrew some crucial support it had put in place. Here's an editorial comment. When I wrote the introduction for the new edition that refers to the author, Alyssa Quart. As a result, insecurity was suddenly normalized. When people emerged from the pandemic fog, they found that paying bills on credit and not having enough to eat had become an everyday experience. The abrupt precarity was felt hardest by the poorest Americans, but they were not alone. Insecurity is felt pretty far up the income ladder, says Friedlein, referring to a growing class of people whom I have called the middle precariat. Those making $35,000 a year in San Francisco, for instance, cannot meet their basic survival needs. But in the same area, even a family living on $200,000 may also find itself precarious, pouring resources into health insurance or scrambling to afford tuition. Part of what has caused economic insecurity is that we have come to rely more on credit and debt in the past few decades, a phenomenon taking place at all income levels except for the super rich. This particular flavor of economic insecurity has caused some voter alienation from traditional politics. If you're weighed down by your bad credit score, a relatively new measurement, as Friedlein points out, how can you focus on marching or organizing or even voting? In a world of terra infirma, the shakiest ground of all may be our broken and rigged healthcare system. The U.S. spends twice as much on healthcare per capita as other countries. And Americans still constantly worry about affording treatment, accessing doctors in a timely fashion, or being able to get a clear diagnosis. As Kate Nicholson, executive director and founder of the National Pain Advocacy Center, told me, many of the people she works with are fed up with medical insecurity, stemming, say, from procedures routinely denied by insurance companies at the 11th hour, even after doctors and nurses have scrubbed and are ready to operate. It was something I experienced myself. Again, this is the author, Quart, speaking, when I was diagnosed with long COVID last year. Even with health insurance, I had to wait months to see doctors who might have the expertise to figure out what was happening. It took 5 months to get even a quasi-accurate diagnosis. In that time, I paid out of pocket for complex tests not covered by insurance. So what can we do? To combat this shaky malaise, we first have to break out of our neurotic isolation. We must seek the glimmer of the Soviet era's kitchen table culture, what the anthropologist Victor Turner called communitas. In this moment of rupture and uncertainty, this sort of solidarity can be an unexpected salve. Once we realize our predicament is not our fault, we must organize to change the systems that make us insecure. One solution is better regulation of the draconian health insurance plans and the mainstream banking system, so that both may behave in more moral ways. All this regulation, of course, rests on our electing better and more effective politicians who recognize how many of us suffer from insecurity. We also need to look down and recognize that we are all standing on terra infirma. Anyone without the means to build a bunker to wait out the inevitable shocks, that is. With that recognition, we must each develop a clearer understanding of how those in power deliberately exploit our individual and societal uncertainty and what we can do about it. This story was co-published and supported by the journalism nonprofit, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. There's one photo here, approximately a fourth of a page. It's in color. We see the backs of numerous people. Some have shopping carts with them, the kind that people might take from their house to the bus or the subway. In one shopping cart, there's also a folding chair. The people are bundled up against the winter. They have winter or at least medium weight coats on, many with hoods, some with caps. Apparently they're men and women. I see pants and skirts alike, again, from the back. The caption reads, "People waiting at a food bank in Brooklyn, February 28, 2024. Turning the page now to the cover article. health. More young adults are getting cancer. Researchers are racing to understand why. By Jamie Ducharme. A photo. It was just the heads of the people that we saw on the cover. Here we have them seated on stools and on chairs and on a table, and they are Imtiaz Hussein, 31, diagnosed with colon cancer at 26. Carrie Reagan, 41, diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 40. Kelly Spill, 33, diagnosed with colorectal cancer at 28. Giancarlo Oviedo Mori, 32, diagnosed with lung cancer at 18. The credit for the photo goes to Frankie Alduino for Time. Turning now to the text, this is a lengthier article. Let's see if it's co-reported or co-authored. Nope. It looks like it's all by Jamie Ducharme. Dr. Frank Frizzell has operated on countless patients in his career as a colorectal surgeon, but there's one case that stayed with him. In 2014, he was treating a woman in her late 20s suffering from bowel cancer, already a rare situation given her age. But it became even more unusual when her best friend visited her in the hospital and told Frizzell that she had many of the same symptoms as his patient. Subsequent testing revealed his patient's friend has had a lesion that, had it not been caught early, likely would have become cancerous. That really brought it home to me how it's much more common than you think, says Frizzell, a professor of surgery at the University of Otago in New Zealand. Still, like any good scientist, Frizzell was skeptical. Was it simply a fluke that he kept treating strikingly young patients? Or was his practice one tiny data point in a larger trend? He found his answer after sifting through national health data. Colorectal cancer, he discovered, was indeed becoming diagnosed more often than in previous years among New Zealanders under 50. Further research by Frizzell analyzing populations in Sweden and Scotland showed the same thing. A bigger picture was emerging. Here were three different countries with different populations and health challenges, but united by a spike in colorectal cancers among young adults. In the years since, it's become clear the problem is not limited to those three countries, nor to colorectal cancer. Researchers have found young people around the world are getting many different kinds of cancer at alarmingly high rates. As the diagnoses of celebrities and public figures like Kate Middleton, Chadwick Boseman, Dwayne Wade, and Olivia Munn bring mass attention to the issue, scientists are racing to answer a question on the minds of many outside the medical profession. Why is cancer, historically a disease of old age, increasingly striking people in the primes of their lives? Globally, diagnoses and deaths related to early onset cancers, those affecting patients younger than 50, rose by 79% and 28% respectively from 1990 to 2019. According to a recent study published in the medical journal BMJ Oncology, in the U.S., breast cancer is the most common type of early onset disease, but recent surges in cancers affecting digestive organs, including the colon, rectum, pancreas, and stomach, are particularly dramatic within this age group. In fact, today's young adults are about twice as likely to be diagnosed with colon cancer, four times as likely to be diagnosed with rectal cancer as those born around 1950, research suggests. Overall, cancer is still overwhelmingly an older person's disease. As of 2025, 88% of people in the U.S. diagnosed with cancer were 50 or older, and 59% were 65 or older, according to data from the American Cancer Society. But there's no question the demographics are shifting. Under 50s are not only at increasing risk of suffering from cancer, theirs is the only age group for which the risk is rising. All told, 17 types of cancer are on the rise among U.S. adults in this age group. When we were younger, we assumed the climate would be the same forever. The same applies in cancer, says Dr. Thomas Paulus, a UK-based oncologist and cancer researcher who edits the journal Annals of Oncology. We just assumed that cancer incidence was something that's relatively static, but it's not. There is some good news in the data. Advances in disease detection and treatment, as well as dramatic declines in smoking, mean that far fewer people die from cancer now than once did. Although the disease still ranks as the second most common cause of death in the U.S., killing more than 500,000 people each year, mortality rates have dropped by about a third since 1991. Less encouragingly, the rate of new cancers diagnosed has remained stubbornly consistent, declining only modestly from 1999 to 2021. Across the U.S., roughly 2 million new cancer cases are detected each year, diagnoses that, on top of the emotional toll, force patients to cumulatively fork out billions of dollars in out-of-pocket costs, more than $16 billion in 2019 alone, according to federal data. Today, about 40 out of every 100 U.S. adults can expect to be diagnosed with cancer at some point in their lifetimes. For an estimated 1 in 17 U.S. women and 1 in 29 U.S. men, that news will come before their 50th birthdays. The rise in early onset diagnoses partly comes down to advances in our ability to detect and diagnose different kinds of cancer. With much more sophisticated tools now, inevitably, we are doing more tests on younger people and we're using more accurate imaging, which leads to more cancers detected, Paulus said. Some screening protocols have also been modified in recent years to include younger adults. Since 2018, for example, the American Cancer Society has recommended colonoscopy starting at age 45, down from 50. But this is only one part of what scientists say is a more complex web of factors they're still attempting to understand. The data suggest that some element, or perhaps combination of elements, of modern life is sickening progressively younger adults. And right now, no one knows for sure what that is. There are plenty of known risk factors for cancer, from the genes someone is born with to the unhealthy lifestyle habits they pick up, such as smoking, drinking lots of alcohol, or spending time in the sun. Such habits can speed up the natural degradation of cells, which over time acquire genetic mutations as they lose their ability to repair damage. As that damage accumulates with age, cells may become cancerous, growing and multiplying too fast for the body's immune system to keep them in check, and potentially choking out vital organs. The immune system also loses some of its strength with age, making it easier for cancer cells to colonize the body. But classic risk factors do not seem to fully explain the recent rise in early onset cancers, says Dr. Kathy Eng, ENG, director of the Young Adult Cancers Program at Vanderbilt University's Ingram Cancer Center in Tennessee. Some of the trends are baffling. Young, non-smoking women, for example, are being diagnosed with lung cancer in strangely high numbers. Many times, Eng's patients were extremely healthy. Vegetarians, marathon runners, avid swimmers. That's why I really believe there's other risk factors to account for this, she says. There is no shortage of theories about what those may be. Many scientists point to modern diets, which tend to be heavy on potentially carcinogenic products, including ultra-processed foods, red meat, and alcohol, and may also contribute to weight gain, another cancer risk factor. The foods we eat can also affect the gut microbiome, the colony of microbes that lives in the digestive system and appears linked to overall health. Alterations to the gut microbiome via diet or perhaps exposure to drugs like antibiotics have also been implicated. I'll stop here to describe a photo. It is of one person standing in a room with a window in it and lots of cabinetry upon which stand what I'm going to call vials of specimens. Yeah. Okay, this gentleman is dressed in a blue suit, white shirt, blue tie. He has short-cropped grayish-black hair. He's wearing glasses. It is Dr. Shuji Ogino, or Ogino, O-G-I-N-O, a pathologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, studying early-onset cancer using a unique approach that combines epidemiology, the study of population-level health trends, and molecular pathology, the granular analysis of a patient's tumor. He believes this unlikely pairing will help uncover triggers for early-onset disease. Returning now to the text, other researchers blame the microplastics littering our environment and leaching into our food and water supplies, some of which, according to a 2024 study, have even shown up in cancer patients' tumors. Other environmental factors could also be to blame, given that everything from cosmetics to food packaging contains substances that many researchers are not convinced are safe. Even our near constant exposure to artificial light could be messing with normal biological rhythms in ways that have profound health consequences, some research suggests. For now, these are all just hypotheses. Some may turn out to be wrong, and more theories will emerge in time. It is also likely that different risk factors are linked to different cancers, Frizzell says. Even in a single patient, multiple overlapping triggers may be in play. Frizzell's research on colorectal cancer, for example, suggests there may be a dysfunctional relationship between microplastics, certain foods, and some types of gut bacteria. Studies suggest that when microplastics get into the body, they can penetrate the mucus lining that protects the bowels and carry bacteria and toxins to the bowel lining. This leaves the bowel more susceptible to damage from pathogens inside the body, including strains of gut bacteria that are known to become more virulent when they interact with compounds found in red and processed meat. In some patients, this perfect storm of invaders may result in cancer, Frizzell thinks. He believes this overlapping puzzle of risk factors is a likelier explanation than any one lifestyle habit driving a dramatic uptick in cancers, especially since younger generations are, in many respects, healthier than their ancestors. In the U.S., for example, tobacco use has plummeted in recent decades, and young adults are increasingly unlikely to drink. How is the health-conscious generation getting more bowel cancer? Frizzell asks. Dr. Andrea Cercek, co-director, that's C-E-R-C-E-K, co-director of the Center for Young Onset Colorectal and Gastrointestinal Cancers at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, agrees. Some early onset cancer cases defy easy explanation. She has treated patients in their 20s and even teens with tumors that biologically look just like a regular 80-year-old's tumor. These cases stump her. Even if they drank as a teenager, it just does not make sense, she says. A few years of drinking alcohol, following an unhealthy diet, or having obesity should not be enough to produce the kind of tumor typically seen in a senior citizen, Cercek says, and yet there they are. To Cercek, these advanced tumors suggest people have been exposed to damaging substance for a long time, perhaps even longer than they were aware of. Research and awareness about early onset cancer is accumulating now, but the source of the problem may not be new, Cercek says. It can take years for even the most toxic exposures to result in health problems, which means the source of a problem in the public eye now may have emerged decades ago, silently sickening people, until the trend became too pronounced to ignore. I'm forging ahead now and abbreviating this quite long article. There is yet another question for researchers to answer. Whether on a molecular level, young patients' cancers are dramatically different from those that occur in older people. If so, these findings may guide researchers toward new treatment approaches. Some research, including by Eng, has pointed to molecular differences, at least among patients with early onset colorectal disease. But other scientists are less convinced. Paulus, the UK oncologist, says he has not seen strong evidence to suggest early onset cancers are much different or more aggressive than later in life cancers. They just happen to strike patients at younger ages. The ultimate goal, of course, and the ultimate win for doctors and researchers working in this field will be for early onset cancer centers to be rendered unnecessary. But it likely will not happen anytime soon. Proponents of sophisticated new artificial intelligence technologies have raised expectations, promising new tools that could transform cancer research. AI gives scientists the ability to sift through mountains of data with hitherto unimaginable levels of precision. And the hope is that these tools will unlock a cascade of new discoveries, illuminating unrecognized risk factors, for example, and turbocharging the new development of new treatments. But cancer researchers remain cautious. There is hope, no doubt, but like the legions of scientists grappling with complex medical puzzles in other fields, they are wary of overstating the pace of progress and raising the hopes of patients, even with new technologies at their disposal. If the challenge sounds daunting for researchers like Ogino from Brigham and Women's, the complexities are part of the process. He's reminded every day that good science takes as long as it takes. Many of the tumor samples he relies on in his research came from participants enrolled in a study that launched in 1976. The researchers who started it could not have known that 50 years later, their work would be critical in the quest to reverse the rise of early onset cancer, Ogino says. That's the kind of legacy you can make in science, he says. That is a great, rewarding way to contribute, even if it takes a lot of time to get there. Again, that article was abridged, written by Jamie Ducharme. Time off, cavalcade of comedy. As Saturday Night Live celebrates its 50th season, alumni look back on the people, moments, and humor that shaped their time as an American institution. 1970s, Garrett Morris at SNL from 1975 to 1980. I'm trying to determine who wrote this. Well, maybe here we go. It's as told to Olivia B. Waxman. Okay, that gives us something. I had been in show business for about 17 years before Saturday Night Live came along. I was an actor on and off Broadway. I wrote a couple plays. I did a lot of musicals. SNL was my first television job, a job paying me more than I'd ever been paid before, and I was finally paying my rent. I am an introvert, so I would usually just do the show and go back to my apartment. That was a mistake, because what you're supposed to do is go to the bar, hang out with the group, develop relationships. There were some drugs. I was a cocaine fiend, but a teetotaler when it came to alcohol. But back on set, being the one black guy, I was just concerned about whether I'd be used at all. It was not an unusual experience to be the one black person in a cast of mostly white people. I had to fight to get people to write for me. Lorne Michaels came up with the premise of a sketch featuring guys on death row performing as the Death Row Follies. All he had was a premise. We had to go to our dressing room and come up with something. I remembered this scene from Art Linkletter, a very popular talk show host in the 1950s, where a white lady from down south sang, "I'm gonna get me a shotgun and shoot all the N's I see." I realized if I replaced N with Whitey, I'd have the perfect song for a black man on death row, so that's how I came up with that sketch. I also was proud of the fact that I came up with the idea for the White Guilt Relief Fund sketch. There was a running joke in the black community about groups like the Black Panthers, SNCC, CORE, the NAACP, who would regularly go out fundraising. All black groups got some money, but groups that had a goodly amount of white liberals got much more. People are still arguing about whether there should be reparations for slavery, and the idea of a white guilt relief fund was a way of talking about a very serious economic subject in a comedic way. Whether you were a Democrat or a Republican, you got hit by the comedy of SNL. Now the whole country's sort of sideways, so you have to be very brave to make fun of a lot of what should be made fun of. It does not seem quite as courageous as it was then. There was a lot of energy and a lot of beautiful people. I was just amazed at the brilliance of the improvisation. Gilda Radner, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, they were all just such talented people, and I was really honored to be a part of that group. 1980s, Al Franken at SNL from 1975 to 1980. In 1985 to 1995. On election night, 1988, I was returning in a small jet to New York from Boston, where I had just emceed Michael Dukakis' victory party. Looking down at the lights of a New England town shimmering below, I mused wistfully about the majesty of our democracy. My candidate had not prevailed, but our system was still the envy of the world, or at least a sizable part of it. F-space, UCK, moaned an anguished John Lovitz, the plane's only other passenger. I turned around to commiserate, but before I could, John shared the real reason for his bitter disappointment. Now, Dana gets to be the president. John had played Dukakis on SNL, so we flew up to entertain the Dukakis team. It was already clear at the start of the evening things were not going the governor's way, and my first joke was, well, it feels like it's either going to be a close one or we will win by a landslide. By the time John appeared as Dukakis, Bush had been declared winner, but the trooper got laughs from the dispirited crowd. Still, John was glum on the trip back. Throughout SNL's history, playing the president was a guarantee of lots of airtime. Think of Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford, Dan Aykroyd's Jimmy Carter, Phil Hartman's Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, Will Ferrell's George W. Bush. SNL has enjoyed the enviable position of being the only live sketch comedy show that could comment in real time on current events. Yes, late night shows do jokes about politics, but only SNL comprises sketches with sets, costumes, occasional special effect. This creates the obligation that if Surgeon General Joycelyn Elder said on a Thursday that school children should be taught about masturbation, SNL had to have Ellen Cleghorn do Elders on live TV 2 days later. Over my 15 seasons at SNL across 3 decades, I wrote hundreds of sketches, many with longtime writer and producer Jim Downey. And Jim came up with a maxim for the political ones: reward people for knowing stuff, but do not punish them for not knowing stuff. We knew part of the audience had a sophisticated understanding and part of it did not. Our goal was to get laughs from everyone. A few weeks before the election, Jim and I wrote a Bush-Dukakis debate sketch. Some jokes were big fat ones for everyone. John's shorter Dukakis requiring a motorized lift to reach a suitable height behind the podium. Going too high, grinding to a stop, lowering back down, another harsh stop. Some jokes were subtler for the clued-in audience. Bush's 1,000 points of light and vague nod to a kinder, gentler nation, a nice sentiment with absolutely no policy behind it. The biggest laugh came after a slow build that brought the low-information viewers along. Kevin Nealon, as panelist Sam Donaldson, asks Dana Carvey's Bush for specifics on how he would address fundamental problems like hunger and homelessness. Carvey's Bush offers vague platitudes before saying that, unfortunately, his time is up, to which Jan Hooks, as moderator Diane Sawyer, responds with a cheeky smile, "Mr. Vice President, you still have a minute 20. A volley ensues, Carvey's Bush desperately insisting he's out of time, and Hooks Sawyer calmly assuring him he's got more, and he finally lays out a meaningless summary. On track, stay the course, 1,000 points of light. As for a rebuttal, Lovitz's Dukakis throws up his hands. I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. The audience exploded with laughter and applause. We did not take sides. That was never our goal. It was just to do well-observed, dare I say, smart commentary. For decades, the show avoided veering into advocacy. That would wait until Trump became president. I need to start abridging this rather lengthy article. This is a 2010 Cecily Strong at SNL from 2012 to 2022. This is as told to Aaron McMullen. That previous article about Al Franken apparently was written by him. There's no other byline. Anyway, on to Cecily Strong. One of the things I loved most when I was performing on Saturday Night Live was creating controlled chaos. When I was doing my Jeanine Pirro impression, I wanted to be spilling drinks or throwing up. When I did the fainting couch sketch with Benedict Cumberbatch, I loved crashing into the furniture and breaking everything on set. It's fun for the audience to watch chaos somehow be corralled on live television, and I think my appearance on Weekend Update as Goober the Clown was its own version of that. A month after Texas' 6-week abortion ban went into effect in 2021, I texted an idea for a sketch to my friend Aaron Doyle, who's also a producer at SNL. I come on Update as a woman who had an abortion when she was 23, and I'm in a clown suit with the nose and everything, and I make jokes and talk in a funny voice, but I'm just Cecily, and I had an abortion when I was 23. I wondered if it was a bad idea, but I had spent the few weeks before that riddled with anxiety over the fact that reproductive rights were up for grabs in this country, and I hoped that trying to say something, anything, about my own real-life experience with abortion on the show would help me sleep at night. Because, yes, SNL is a fart joke funny place, but it's also a huge platform. Erin replied she thought the idea might be genius, so we brought in writers Kent Sublett and Anna Drazen to help shape the sketch into what eventually aired that Saturday. Me, dressed as a clown named Goober, talking about clown abortions, while my big clown bow tie spun in circles, and I tried to make Colin Jost a balloon animal, which I obviously could not do. Sharing something so personal in such a silly way felt like controlled chaos to me. I was nervous and terrified because I knew the kind of violence this sketch could provoke in people, but I knew what I had the support of. I knew I had the support of the whole cast behind me. Mostly I felt really powerful. Women are so used to being told we can only feel shame around the decisions that we make about our bodies, so it felt good to say on live television, getting an abortion does not make you a terrible person. To this day, after having spent over a decade on the show, Goober the Clown is the thing I'm proudest of. I think SNL is at its best when cast members are able to show they're human. It was cathartic to take control of the narrative like that in front of the world, and I still tear up when I think about the kind and vulnerable messages I received from other women after the sketch aired. I hope it was cathartic for them, too. This is the 2020s, and I hope I'm saying this person's name correctly, Ego, E-G-O, Nwodim, N-W-O-D-I-M. At SNL from 2018 to the present, and this is as told to Olivia B. Waxman. A few days before lockdown in March 2020, I celebrated my birthday. Before getting cast on SNL in 2018, I had come up as a comedian in Los Angeles, so by early 2020, I still did not feel quite like a New Yorker. Walking home after the celebration, I saw the red New Yorker sign in the skyline. I sighed, ah, yes, how symbolic. I may officially be a New Yorker. It did not take 48 hours for that bubble to burst. Days later, I'm hunkered down in my studio apartment, way too close to Port Authority. Not an ideal place on a regular day, let alone during a pandemic. After 2 weeks in lockdown, it was unclear when we would be returning to work. Then we were notified we would be producing sketches from home. Talk about unprecedented times. None of us really understood what this meant, but we rose to the occasion. We figured out that at-home episodes would not be live, and we would be shooting sketches on our phones and being directed via Zoom. There was no pitch meeting, no table read, no blocking. We were our own lighting and camera operators. Thank God for our brilliant editors and crew. I had always known they were integral to what we do, but I came to fully understand just how invaluable their work is. One day I'll tell of the daily meltdowns I had in that studio apartment, trying to break down the giant green screen the show sent us. They were probably about something else, but I like to blame the green screen. One of my favorite sketches from that time did not involve my green screen nemesis and was not even intended for the show. It's now called Quarantine Cutie, but it was originally just an Instagram story I had done early in lockdown. In it, I was drawing on my face with marker and doing a beauty tutorial as a woman who's run out of all sanity and all her makeup. I was not thinking any profound thoughts. I just took a shower and thought, be stupid. I was having an experience, as much as my castmates and I tried to entertain during the pandemic, we were still just people having an experience. We've had people say they're so grateful we showed up in that way. People say those episodes were not great, fair, but they appreciated having the show go on. In those moments, you realize how much people look to SNL for some semblance of comfort. We made people feel less alone and like maybe things would be okay. We could take a beat to try to remember laughter and bring levity to a heavy time. In the minute or so that we have left, I'll show you the names of the people I left out of that SNL roster. Sherry O'Terry from the 1990s. Rachel Dratch from the 2000s. And that's about it. Again, that was a retrospective in the time off section for the Cavalcade of Comedy, Saturday Night Live, known as SNL. The cover of this section is a full-page photograph. Gosh, I can't begin to identify all the people whose faces appear in this illustration. I think I see Chevy Chase, Gilda Radner. There are dozens of them. Oh, that must be Belushi, but he's wearing a top hat and tux. Some folks are seated front and center. I cannot identify them for you either, but there are at least 20 faces that emerge from this photograph on Time Off. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.